Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we talk to the granddaughter of the founder of Cooksville, one of the largest Black settlements in the Valley during the era of the Great Migration. And 1 year after the Porterville Library burned down, there's an effort underway to provide books to residents. But first, we're going to tell you about a program started by two close friends who were looking for a way to help older women during the pandemic. It's called Save Las Señoras, and as FM89's Madi Bolaños reports, it delivers groceries and information to households in Fresno County.
Marlene Miranda juggles three bags of groceries as she looks through a screen door of an apartment in Kerman.
Yes, at your door.
Oh, it's a lady.
Miranda tells 92-year-old Esther Velarde she's not allowed to enter the house for safety reasons, but she leaves the bags filled with milk, eggs, beans, and other groceries on her doorstep. Velarde comes outside and tells Miranda the pandemic has taken a toll on her mental health.
There's days when I feel so bad, I don't open the door for nobody.
In addition to her age, Velarde has several health conditions, including arthritis, that make her a high-risk candidate for catching COVID.
I leave it close, and I stay in there, and I crochet my part of my life all the way there.
But she says she likes crocheting, and it's helped temper her arthritis. She's almost done working on a blanket for herself.
Yeah, well, I have to enjoy myself because they don't let me go out.
Velarde is referring to her kids who want her to stay safe. She lives alone but has made friends in her apartment complex that are all older too, she says. She also has a caretaker named Maria who signed her up to receive groceries from Save Las Señoras. Miranda says about half of the women who benefit from this service live alone, but
the ones that I've gone to usually have, they live with somebody. But too, what I've noticed is they alternate, like they live like a few months with one kid and then they go on to the other kids if they have multiple.
Miranda began helping with Save Las Señoras in October when the program received funding from the COVID-19 Equity Project. She says the collaboration helps them get important information regarding COVID to residents that typically don't leave their home.
When we drop off, we'll just let them know, hey, you know, aquí le pusimos información sobre el coronavirus. And we'll explain to them what flyers we put in there because we have quite a few flyers that we give out.
In March, Genoveva Islas, the executive director at Cultiva La Salud, and her best friend, Maribel Sandoval, started Save Las Señoras. Isla says they received an anonymous $10,000 donation, and all of that money went to purchasing groceries and cleaning supplies for older women.
We wanted to help provide as much resource that would protect them from becoming infected by limiting, you know, how often they had to leave their home.
Isla says they chose to focus on women in the Latinx community because they often do the cooking, but they provide enough food for the entire household.
And so if this woman happened to live with her husband, we would still be doing the same delivery, and she would likely still be doing the same food preparation for her family.
Since then, they've received funding from different COVID-19 initiatives. Maribel Sandoval became the director as the program started to grow. Each month, she calls the participants to find out exactly what they need.
Anything else, they want beans, they want lentejas, they want, you know, black beans. So like I said, everybody gets a personal bag.
In order to use the program, Sandoval says the señoras have to be 65 years or older. She gets the word out by posting information at local health clinics and other outlets.
Through Radio Bilingue, we put out flyers. We have a lot of señoras that we've dealt with in the past.
Every week, employees pack the personalized grocery bags and set off to different areas in Fresno County, Sandoval says.
1 week we'll do Eastside, One week we do West Side, and then one week we'll do Fresno.
This week, it's West Fresno County.
Hola, buenas tardes. Sí, le vengo a dejar la dispensa de...
Marlene Miranda is now at the home of 65-year-old Raquel Gallegos in Biola. She passes off the 3 bags of groceries. Gallegos says she heard about the program at her local health clinic.
I called and got in touch, and yeah, they have been able to help, and thank God, because it's been a great help.
Gallegos lives with her husband and son. All three of them have health conditions that put them at a higher risk of contracting COVID, so Gallegos says she's always looking for ways to minimize her risk. And Miranda says she's noticed many of the señoras she delivers to are taking good precautions.
It's really nice, too. Like, I've seen some señoras, when we drop off the food, the groceries, they disinfect them before they take them in.
The program currently assists over 60 women with monthly groceries. And Genoveva Islas says it's received more funding from the city to start delivering to women in West Fresno. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Madi Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The city of Sanger experienced a proud moment this week with the induction of Tom Flores into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The Sanger native has had a historic career in the NFL, and as FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, he's left a mark on his hometown that's still celebrated today.
Two electric lifts move alongside a freshly painted mural on 7th Street in downtown Sanger. Painters are doing touch-ups on the piece created by Valley artist Omar Super Huerta. In the center of the mural is Tom Flores. On either side of him, two football players in Raider colors.
I think it's because of him I became a Raider fan, because I knew, you know, for my family telling me, hey, that guy's from Sanger. It's like, okay, I'm a Raider fan now.
That's former Sanger Mayor Frank Gonzalez. He was still in office last year when talks first started to plan the mural. He says it's become a part of his family's tradition to honor their hometown hero.
When they dedicated Tom Flores Stadium to him, my dad was the mayor at that time. And then he started the Tom Flores Foundation, Youth Foundation, and my brother is the one that designed his logo.
The stadium is located just a half mile away at Washington Academic Middle School, what used to be Sanger High School, where Flores graduated in 1954. Since then, Flores' rise to the pro football ranks has been a barrier-breaking inspiration for this rural, predominantly Latino community. Sanger business owner James Pinedo says it was an inspiring moment to see him inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame this week.
You know, first Latino quarterback in the NFL, first Latino head coach in the NFL. You know, it's a no-brainer. He should have been in years ago, but I'm glad they finally recognized and put him in.
The Tom Flores mural sits on the wall of his building on the corner of 7th and N Streets, and the city is planning another dedication to the Hall of Famer.
The street here, they're going to change it to Tom Flores Boulevard. Another honor to have my building here.
The Hall of Fame announcement has helped to energize the city's efforts to revive its downtown core, starting with the city's first ever mural.
We want this for future generations that haven't really seen or followed his career.
That's Tom Nicholson, chairman of the Sanger Downtown Revitalization Committee. He says honoring Tom Flores built momentum, a goal of rolling out 8 to 12 murals over the next 18 months. Nicholson has a close connection to Tom Flores. His dad, Dean Nicholson, coached him in high school football and basketball.
Personally, I've seen him come back to always meet and greet my dad when he was living. Dad passed 4 years ago, but Tom, anytime he would come into town, would always catch up with who he would call coach.
In fact, Tom Flores' achievements, even before his pro football career, are well documented in Sanger.
This is the Hall of Fame for Sanger athletes.
Ken Mark Antonio is president of the Sanger High School Athletic Hall of Fame. It's housed in a historic building in downtown Sanger. Photos and plaques display the accomplishments of generations of student athletes.
There's his yearbook here.
Tom Flores is featured prominently. Mark Antonio is a retired teacher from Sanger High School, and he used to serve as a member of the Sanger Unified School Board.
I taught for 35 years. And I saw how important athletics were for kids.
Just across from the Hall of Fame, Mark Antonio also manages the Sanger Depot Museum, which features more of Tom Flores' history growing up in Sanger. The museum typically hosts elementary school kids who learn about Flores from a young age. Flores' Youth Foundation has raised thousands of dollars for Sanger Elementary Schools, and he still comes to Sanger for the annual Raider Nation Blood Drive, says Tom Nicholson.
And he's so proud to be part of Sanger's history, too. So we know that he's gone on to achieve great things and great heights, but always to call Sanger your hometown and treasure that.
And Flores continues to make his mark in Sanger. Still to be added to his downtown mural, a quote, and his signature. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When Black Americans fled the oppression of Jim Crow as part of the Great Migration, some came to the Central Valley to establish settlements like Fairmead and Allensworth. Among the largest of those communities was Cookseyville. It was founded by Sid and Olivia Cooksey, who purchased several acres of farmland in Atwater and invited family members to help them establish their own self-sufficient community. I spoke with Sid and Olivia's granddaughter, Jeannie Logan, about her memories of growing up in Cookseyville. She started the conversation by talking about her grandparents' journey from Arkansas to the Central Valley.
So they came out here in the early 40s, and they went up to Richmond, California in the Bay Area, and that wasn't the life for them. I think that they were looking for something a little bit more like Arkansas, a little bit more pasture land and where you can raise your family or you can do what they did in Arkansas. And so as the story goes, they one Sunday afternoon, they did a drive down 99 and they seen some property over in Atwater. They stopped there. They scouted it out. They found where they wanted to be.
So describe Cookseyville. Paint a picture of what this community was like and who lived there.
It was a very interesting place. It was all I knew growing up. So I thought it was a special place because it was us and all of our relatives. And we had everything. Cookseyville, we had an auntie, Aunt Icy. She was my dad's sister. And she had a grocery store there. We didn't go to restaurants until we basically got to be of age, grown, and could drive and do other things. All of our meals were cooked at home. We raised hogs and cows, and they did a lot of fishing. They grew their own vegetables, so we had large gardens. My mother had a green thumb that you wouldn't believe. She could grow everything. They were a community that was all-inclusive. They had everything. So you said, well, what happened? Who built what? How did the houses get built? Well, uncle, he was a plumber. Another uncle was a laborer. He did cement. Another uncle was a carpenter. So they built their own houses. They built the store. They built the church. And so it was a place where we would, you know, after school, we would get up and go outside and we would play with each other. And it was just a lot of lot of fun. You know, there was a canal bank there. We didn't have a pool, but we did swim in the canal, and it was cement paved. So we would swim in the canal and we would play kickball, and Mr. Jackson would come and he would bring tea cakes. And we said, here comes the tea cake man. Here comes the tea cake man. And my mom soon put a stop to that. And she started making tea cakes. Now, my mom was one of the women in the group that could really, really cook. My dad was what they call the king of the barbecue. You know, they all had their own little skills and gifts that they brought to the table and shared among one another. So we were a tight community, and we could depend on each other for whatever we needed. One of the things that my grandmother, she was a very intelligent woman. I got the facts on this. She did go to school. She was what you would call to be a mathematician. She tutored a lot of her children and her grandchildren how to do not just adding and subtracting, but algebra. So she helped them
get through school by tutoring them. She was a midwife back in Arkansas. She was the mastermind behind the good man, Mr. Sid Cooksey. They worked together. They were entrepreneurs. They knew what they wanted. They went after it and they came together. She would always say, come here, sit down and let's count. Let me make sure that you know how to count. And make sure you know how to, when you're purchasing something, that you can count that money back because you don't want to get cheated. Also, you had to work. Nothing was given to you and you were expected to work. And she would say a person that does not have a job will steal because you want to feed yourself. So she made sure that the family was educated. You see professors and doctors and lawyers and nurses and business entrepreneurs and all types of people in our family.
What was it about your childhood in Cookseyville that you think contributed to the success that its residents went on to have?
It was just instilled in us that we had to work. And you could choose and be whatever you want it to be, but you had to work because nothing would be given to you. Even though my grandfather left land for us and everything, and they purchased land and we, they subdivided it between all of their children, and they probably had to pay for it. I don't think they just got it, but you had everybody worked. And even if you were a housewife, you work because you had to manage the family. You had to work in the garden. You had to milk the cows and kill the chickens, feed the chickens. You worked. And it was just instilled in us that, you can be and do anything that you wanted to do. So, and then we went to school and we seen opportunities of different things in different areas that we can go into. But because my aunt had a store, she had a store, on the corner, we knew that, if she could do that, we can do whatever we wanted to do. And my aunt, my grandmother was a midwife. So there's a lot of nurses and doctors in our family.
So I'd like to talk a bit about race and being surrounded by family, being surrounded by people who look like you, who can instill a sense of pride in who you are. And I'm wondering if you could just speak a little bit to what that experience was like for you.
I remember the name Cooksey heavily having influence. You just kind of stated what your name was. Not that it had influence that we were wealthy or anything like that, but that we were rich in our belief in God and our belief in community and helping each other, and that it was many of us. So I was sharing this with my cousin, who was born in 1944, and how was his time at school? Because I came along, I was born in 1960. So I came along in the 70s, being in high school and things like that. And it was a little bit different than the 40s. So what was that like? He told me that his experience was not that bad. You knew what was going on. You knew what was expected. The parents told you, how people thought. And he said there was rarely an incident in Atwater where they ran into anyone. There was no one coming out and burning crosses in our property or anything like that. We didn't see a lot of that, even though we knew that it existed. My mom, she's from Louisiana. She would say, now in the South, it was open. You knew who was prejudiced. You knew exactly what you were dealing with. But out in California, it was more undercover and underhanded. And it was there. But the feeling that I got, they respected more of knowing than someone stabbing you in the back because you thought that they were your friend. You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And so when you can see it, you can deal with the enemy if it's an enemy. But when you cannot see it, it's a little bit more difficult and uncomfortable. So that was basically it in high school. We had a great time in high school. The only thing that I did not like was, it was, hey, Cooksey. And I thought, oh, I can't wait to get out of here because I do have a first name. but it was just always, hey, Cooksey. Everybody was just a Cooksey. It's like, are you serious? We have first names. Quit calling me that. And so I'll kind of laugh about that, but it was so many of us.
So how many Cookseys? How big was Cookseyville at its peak? I mean, approximately.
I can say this. I had 27 first cousins. So if those 27 first cousins all had, you know, I have five children. So if all of them had five, then it's a lot. I know now at the reunions, if everybody showed up, it would be a good 500. It'd be a good 500. Everybody showed up.
And that is remarkable.
It is. It's really a blessing to leave a legacy like that.
You know, before we wrap up, I'm wondering if you could reflect on the legacy of Cookseyville and why it matters to hold on to these stories and these histories.
Well, the legacy we leave is a part of the ongoing foundation of life. Those who lived before us left a world for us to live in. They created this space for us. They created opportunity for us. They shared their history. They shared their skills so that we would have something that was in our soul, in our spirit, that could not be taken, that could not be broken away from us. And that we could take that along with what we learn in school and in life itself. We could take that and build a foundation for our family. Some legacies, they provide good and bad, but you know, we were just really blessed to have grandparents that and parents that had a foundation in a Christian foundation, a foundation knowing God. And with that, you could move mountains, as they would say. You know, if you knew how to pray, my mom would say, if you live right, you eat right, and you pray right, you will be all right. And I think that everything that is going on in the world right now in 2021, the fear of not knowing what's going on next, it was instilled in us that the inner man, God, we could go to him and pray, have faith and not walk in fear of what was going to happen tomorrow, but just trust in knowing that everything was going to be all right. You know, as I look back, it just reminds me, we're so grateful that it was just, and I don't know if people have had this experience, I'm sure, but I'm grateful that we had this opportunity. Some people say, oh, I wish we were rich, or I wish we had this, or I wish we had that. Not I, you know, I am grateful for the foundation. I'm grateful for thinking about the cookies, you know, my cookie monsters, thinking about the pies, thinking about the love, thinking about the life, the laughter, the joy, and really thinking about how you can take nothing and make something out of it with your hands, with your soul, with your mind, whatever you believed in. Whatever you desired, you had the faith, you could do it. And I watched them build a community, a township. I watched them speak into other people's lives outside of the little village that we lived in and share, you know. And it's really funny. One time, I don't know, I may tell you to edit this part, but I'm going to tell you right now. When we would get in trouble, and it wasn't a punishment, but you probably won't even imagine what I'm getting ready to say. My mom would say, you know what? You need to go over there and just pray through. So instead of getting a whipping, it was like, oh, no, you need to go pray through. Get over there on your knees and you just think about what you did. And you pray through till God changes you. It's like, oh. Out. It's like, okay, I want a whooping, you know, it's so funny. Just give me a whooping so I can go and play, go back to what I was doing. And, you know, and so that's where we learn to just pray through when trouble comes or something's not right in the family or in your situation. You just go over there and you get on your knees and you pray until you hear an answer from God, you know. And the psychology behind that is that you felt better. he just kind of felt better about the situation. And sometimes I did fall asleep, and I think she might have been happy about that because you couldn't get in trouble if you're asleep. But it was just a happy, happy place to be.
That was Jeannie Logan talking about her childhood growing up in Cooksville, a Black settlement established by her grandparents in the 1940s. If you want to learn more about the history of another Central Valley Black community, the Tulare County Library is hosting a virtual discussion February 27 of the book Allensworth, The Freedom Colony, a California African-American Township by Alice C. Royal. You can register for this free event at the Tulare County Library website. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When Governor Gavin Newsom stopped in Fresno earlier this week, he was widely anticipated to announce that Fresno would be the site of the state's newest mass COVID-19 vaccination clinic, to be established with help from the federal government. But a big announcement still hasn't come. With more on what this means, and with a view of the vaccine rollout from Tulare and Kern counties, is Carrie Klein with this week's COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So first, let's start with a broad look across the valley this week.
Right. Okay. Well, so we're going to continue with the good news, the mostly good news. So case rates are falling steadily. It is so good to see the daily new infections where they are now. And so right now, they're at the levels they were back in early December, just after Thanksgiving. So we're not totally beyond, you know, this winter surge just yet, but we're getting close. Hospitals are slowly losing their COVID patients as well. In fact, it was almost exactly a month ago that the number of COVID patients in hospitals hit a peak. And since then, the patient loads have dropped about 40%. So that's awesome. And it looks like we'll finish this week with fewer than 200 reported deaths in our region in total. That is still quite high, but the number is falling. So that is good news, at least.
Well, now let's turn to vaccines. Where are we at in terms of vaccine priority right now? Who exactly is eligible?
So not much has changed on this since last week. So for the most part, counties in our area are prioritizing healthcare workers and seniors, though whether seniors means those over 75 or over 65 varies by county. If you are a food and agriculture worker, a teacher, or a first responder, your eligibility for the vaccine varies by county too. So the best way to find out if you're eligible is to go to your county health department's website, where you can either sign up for appointments online or you can fill out a survey so that you'll be notified when it's your turn. Some counties also have call centers for those without reliable internet access.
So according to state data, 241,000 vaccines have been administered in the San Joaquin Valley so far. That sounds like a huge number, is it?
I mean, on its face, yes. You know, when you think about the fact that this is a brand new vaccination program that started only 2 months ago, it's pretty tremendous. But of course, when you compare that to our total regional population, about 3 million, it's going to take a long time to reach any sort of herd immunity. And, you know, we're still nowhere near meeting the demand that is out there for vaccines right now. You know, and to hear local health officials talk about it, they have the infrastructure to deliver far more vaccines than they're being supplied by the state. So Fresno County, for instance, says that they have the ability to administer 30,000 doses per week, Kern County 45,000 doses per week, but each of them are only receiving around 8,000 doses in a regular week. So that's just a fraction of what they want. And so clinics are having to be scaled back. Here's Timothy Lutz. He is director of Tulare County's Health and Human Services Agency.
We're doing a lot of second dose clinics right now. So we're still vaccinating at a high rate. That the challenge again is based on supply, like a lot of counties, we had to hit the pause button on first round clinics so that we could make sure that we had the vaccine to give second doses to all of those that are ready.
What's also interesting is that not all counties are administering vaccines at the same rate. So the state shares how many vaccines have been administered in each county. And when you look at those doses per capita, our region on the whole has delivered them at a rate that's 40% lower than the state average.
Why is that? I mean, if there's no holdup in getting the vaccines into people's arms, does that mean that the state is not distributing the vaccines to all counties equitably?
Well, that's what many health officials and elected leaders are arguing. Yes. It's hard to confirm that because the state no longer shares data on how many vaccines have actually been shipped to each county. But it does appear that the state is not allocating vaccine doses just by population, but instead by the proportion of each county that's currently eligible. To explain that a little bit more, here's Kern County Public Health Director Bryn Carrigan.
Really, the allocation of supply right now is based off those healthcare worker and 65 and older proportions of population. And we have a healthcare shortage here in Kern County. And then our population is much younger here in Kern. So I think that our allocation is less than some other counties, which does impact the amount that we're able to administer.
In Tulare County, Lutz agrees that this formula for vaccine allocation does not take into account one of the largest industries in the region.
The Central Valley has a disproportionate share of food and agriculture workers just based on where we live, and this is where food grows. So I think what's missing in the state's formula, and unfortunately they haven't been good about providing us information about how allocations are much more granularly focused on each county, but we're not getting additional vaccine to account for our large percentage of food and agriculture workers.
And this allocation formula is also the reason that the Fresno City Council approved a resolution last week to appeal to the Biden administration for more vaccine doses.
So as you said earlier, Governor Newsom paid a last minute visit to Fresno on Wednesday. What did he cover while he was here?
Well, the entire event was a little bit less momentous than I think we were all expecting. He toured the vaccination clinic that's set up at the Fresno Fairgrounds. He met some of the elderly folks who were receiving their vaccinations that day. And he spoke to members of the press in a small event near the Big Milk Jug at the fairgrounds, if you're familiar with the area. The biggest announcement he had was that the state would be leveraging some of their testing sites to become vaccination clinics. These are sites that are run jointly by the state and the company OptumServe to provide free COVID tests. And the first site they selected to do this at in the entire state is at Reedley College. So, you know, in some ways that's good news. It's a part of the county that needs more vaccines. But the downside is that the county health department has to provide those vaccines. So that'd be around 600 doses per week, and that's out of an allocation that's already squeezed really tight. Otherwise, while he was here, Newsom did a lot to praise local leaders for their focus on equity and outreach and testing. And he particularly called out Fresno County's Food and Ag Vaccination Initiative. It was the first program in the Valley to vaccinate farm workers, but it was just a pilot program intended for only 3,000 people.
But while he was here, Newsom did not settle the rumors of where the Central Valley mass vaccination site would go.
That's right. He just repeated, when we have that information, I'll provide it. You know, and for background, he announced on Monday that he would be bringing one of these clinics to the Central Valley. Fresno County has since said it'll be here, and then rumors have swirled after that that it would be at the Save Mart Center, but there's been no official word yet on where specifically it would go. This site would be a big deal for many reasons. You know, one, it would likely deliver thousands of vaccine doses per day. Two, it would be run in partnership with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which means the vaccine supply wouldn't come out of the county allocation. It would be in addition to it, which would be really exciting. But even though a FEMA site would serve anyone, not just Fresno County residents, it still would be difficult for many to access, clearly. Here's Bryn Carrigan again in Kern County.
Transportation is a significant barrier in our community, and expecting our residents to drive 2 hours each way to go and obtain a vaccination is not, you know, really feasible for them. So absolutely, the closer that you can get to Kern, the better.
We talked last week about the challenges to getting vaccinated faced by many demographics, including those in rural areas and those without transportation. Have county health officials shared more about their strategies to get vaccines to these hard-to-reach communities?
Well, you know, first off, counties are distributing vaccines to many community partners, including rural health clinics. Though, of course, it's still really tough to navigate these websites online and find exactly where vaccines might be available. Also, mobile vaccine clinics are gaining traction around the valley, and some are run by county health departments, some by partners, though whether they're sufficient and reaching the right people, time will still need to tell.
Well, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. GOP House Minority Leader and California Representative Kevin McCarthy claimed this week that raising the national minimum wage to $15 per hour could put nearly 4 million Americans out of work. Our colleague at Cap Radio and PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols talked with anchor Mike Haggerty about that claim for the Cap Radio series, Can You Handle the Truth?
Chris, where did McCarthy make the statement? Can you give us some context?
Well, McCarthy made this claim about the wage hike destroying nearly 4 million jobs, both in a news release and on Twitter. He sent out these statements as Democrats in Congress are starting to consider the Raise the Wage Act, and that legislation, if approved, would boost the federal minimum wage from the current $7.25 per hour up to $15 per hour. And it would do that in stages over 5 years. Supporters say it would help lift many Americans out of poverty, and critics are worried that it will force businesses to lay off workers.
Now, California is already on a path toward a $15 per hour minimum wage, right?
That's correct. A few years ago, then-Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that moved California in that direction. By next January, $15 per hour will be the minimum wage at businesses with 26 or more employees. And right now, California's minimum wage is $14 per hour at those businesses.
So what evidence did McCarthy point to when he made his claim about the nearly 4 million job losses from raising the wage?
He includes a link in his press release to a new report published this week by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And that CBO report does say the wage hike could lead to the loss of jobs, but nowhere near as many as McCarthy claimed. It placed what it calls the average estimate at a loss of 1.4 million workers, not the nearly 4 million workers that McCarthy described. And the report goes on to say that there's a smaller chance the loss could be up to 2.7 million positions, but again, still far less than McCarthy's number.
So where did the congressman get his number?
We reached out to his office and did not hear back, but the CBO pointed us to an older report it published from 2 years ago, and we found the high-end estimate of job losses in that older report does match with McCarthy's figure. So it looks like he cherry-picked the worst-case scenario, but not even from a current report on the topic.
In the end, then, how did you rate McCarthy's statement about this wage hike destroying nearly 4 million jobs?
We rated McCarthy's claim as false.
That was Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, speaking with anchor Mike Haggerty. Read full versions of all fact checks at politifact.com/California. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Next week marks the one-year anniversary of the fire in Porterville that destroyed the city's public library and took the lives of firefighter Patrick Jones and fire captain Raymond Figueroa. It was a tragedy that shook the community and left its residents without the many resources a library provides. But a group of community members have launched a project to fill part of that void. Tim and Janet Baker, along with their neighbor Christy Noble, have started the Porterville Little Library Initiative, an effort to dot the town with 100 little libraries, giving children and adults more access to books while they wait for the library to be rebuilt. I spoke with them about the project.
Tim, I'd like to start with you. Can you just describe how the loss of the library and the grief over the lives that were lost in the fire have shaped the community over the last year?
I think it was like a miniature 9/11 for Porterville. And so this last year, 2020, has just been just a harrowing year. because right as that pandemic was starting to kick in, we lost our library. And then we had such a divisive political experience. And so it's kind of a breath of fresh air doing this. We've got a new administration in the White House, and we have a vaccine coming out, so the pandemic might be waning. And we're coming upon that one-year anniversary of that terrible fire and the loss of our firefighters. And so it just makes sense to bring things back to positivity.
So Janet, can you explain how you all came up with the idea for the Porterville Little Library Initiative?
We were talking one day and we said it'd be really nice if we had a little library, because we had seen these as we had traveled, and they have a lot of the little libraries on the coast and throughout California, but we didn't have, I think my husband did some research and found one in a neighborhood near our local Save Mart. Mm-hmm. And so that started the ball rolling, and we figured out, he looked online for the dimensions and started building one. And Christy offered her front yard so we could
work in cahoots.
Install it, yes.
So Christy, explain to us how it works. Where do these books come from? Just describe to someone who's never seen a little library before, what the heck is it?
Oh, well, it's about the size of a kitchen cabinet, and it's stuck on a post in my front yard right next to the curb, so you can just walk up and use it, and it doesn't disturb me at all. It's right by the curb. We have a Friends of the Library in Porterville, and we don't have a library for them to donate money to, so we talked to them. Tim put me in touch with them, and I asked for some books to stock the library with, and they offered them. So I'm going to say yes, of course. So I went out and got my first batch of books from them, and I picked up a mix of kids' books, teenage books, and adult, you know, I don't mean adult, but I mean for grown-ups books, and stocked it. And then I kind of paid attention to see what was moving and what wasn't. And I noticed that the kids' books were getting a lot of traffic, and the grown-up books were getting a lot of traffic. The teens, not so much. And I have actually never seen anybody using it. I just know that when I go out there, the books have changed. So I know it is being used, but it's really straightforward. You see a little library, you bring one of your own books and you just trade. Take one, leave one.
Tim, bring me up to speed on how this initiative is going. How many libraries do you have installed so far? And what is your goal?
My goal is 100 little libraries throughout Porterville and the area, the region around Porterville. We have a total of two installed libraries, ours, and we're getting credit for the extant one that I found across town. And that family is wanting to participate in this, and they want to be a part of our initiative. And so we're going to give them credit as well. And then also we'd like to put a memorial on each one of these to memorialize the two firefighters that lost their lives in the fire.
Janet, can you share your thoughts on the value a library brings to a community?
Just the freedom that books give you, you know, it takes you to a different world.
Yeah.
You know,
Carl Sagan said it's like traveling in time.
They give you dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just expands your imagination. All the things you can do, all the things you can be, all the places that exist. Yeah, it just expands your world.
Given that, can you let us know what you have heard about the rebuilding of the Porterville Library? Is this something that the community is optimistic will happen soon, or does it look like it's going to be a ways out?
I'm estimating 6 years, yeah, just because it takes a long time to get things rolling like that. It's going to take a while. It's going to take a long while. And right now, it just, there's a huge void in the heart of our city.
I do some volunteer work with some kids. I kind of help run a group of American Heritage Girls, which is a scouting organization. And our girls are really, with school the way it is, it's pretty tough on them. And the school libraries have closed, and they just don't have the same opportunities to read. And I think they're losing out because of it. And I think if we had these little libraries, it would give the kids at least a chance to do some reading.
That is such a good point. For those who are listening to this and who would like to help, what should they do?
We need people who are willing to have libraries installed on their property and maintain them. We need people who are willing to donate some money for it, because not everybody who's willing to maintain a library can afford to buy the materials or purchase the library. And if we buy materials, which is the lowest cost alternative to creating these, we need people with skills to help build them.
Well, I've been talking with Tim and Janet Baker and their neighbor, Christy Noble, about the Porterville Little Library Initiative. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you all.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen, for this opportunity.
And finally, it's time for StoryCorps San Joaquin. In today's segment, 53-year-old Joan Yamate Takita talks with her lifelong friend, Celeste Johnston, about what she has learned of her paternal family history. The two also talk about their close friendship. Joan calls Celeste the repository of a lot of her memories. It's why she wants to share this story about her father. When Joan's father was a young boy, he went with his mother to Japan to retrieve his older sister, who had been going to school near Hiroshima. And then Pearl Harbor happened.
I'm supposed to engage you now,
exactly.
Celeste?
You're supposed to be okay. Engaging with me.
Huh? Okay. Well, Celeste, you can attest. You've known my family a long
time. I've known
time.
Your family for
my
a
mom's
long
side,
time.
Though, huh? I want to talk a little bit about my dad's family history. My grandmother and my dad, who was the youngest child, were sent to Japan to bring her back, and also might have not been very good for a young girl to come back by herself on the boat alone.
Yeah.
So as luck would have it, the hometown was in an area or in a village called Tanna, which was around the city of Hiroshima. So here we go with the fun part of the story. So anyhow, Pearl Harbor happened while these people, you know, all born in the United States, American citizens, were in Japan. And so, you know, they couldn't come back. And so suddenly, as my dad would say, suddenly they started using their Japanese middle names. They had to kind of forget they spoke English. And since they kind of grew up speaking English, they had to switch suddenly. And my dad, who grew up kind of on the west side of Fresno, had to stop running around like he's used to running around fields here. Mm-hmm. And over in Japan, everything's a little more contained. Like if you grew up, or, you know, you respect the borders a little more, the fences. So he had to stop running everywhere. And my aunt's been there a long time since she was six. Now she's in junior high or something like that. My dad's there, used to being in the United States. He would actually get in trouble. I guess one time, they had a school, like, assembly, and they called everyone out. And my aunt's there, you know, class president and whatnot. And the principal comes out and says, "We found these two bad boys smoking in the basement."
Oh, no.
And, you know, one of them was my dad.
Your dad, yeah.
Who was, you know, only 5, 6, or 7. So my aunt was mortified. But, you know, there was an adjustment period. They received, you know, the populace around Hiroshima received warning that there was going to be some sort of bombing attack. And the question was put out, hey, would, you know, you want to send your youngsters far away into the country, into the mountains? And so my dad's grandma said, yes, send him, because he was the youngest. Their little town was outside of Hiroshima, the, you know, city proper. My aunt says they just sort of somehow everyone made it back, and they just cleaned up and they waited. My dad eventually came back from the mountains, and he would even say that he said they were starving. They would eat weeds, whatever they could get. And eventually, you know, quite a while later, but, you know, Americans, you know, came in, occupying forces. And then, but my grandma, you know, being born in the United States, was fluent in English. So she would, you know, if she needed to talk with them, she would talk with them. And so, you know, she tried to get maybe extra foodstuffs, candy, whatever, or maybe, hey, you know, the bartering could go that way. You know, so suddenly she became valuable because of her English skills. Yeah. And then
talk to them and
hey, you know, in colloquial English, you know, I was born in Long Beach, you know,
I wonder what the American soldiers thought, having somebody that had said was so fluent and obviously speaking American English.
There are big gaps in the story, but eventually things are settled down. And my grandfather, who was still here in the United States, I think he got sent to an internment camp called Tule Lake, which is for, you know, the bad people, you know, the rabble rousers, you know, go back to Japan type. But I think he ended up in Tule Lake. So he had to make arrangements for them to come back, you know, prove, hey, this is where they were born, you know, et cetera. And my dad came back. I don't think he graduated high school till he was 20. Because he had to redo relearn all his English.
My dad had he graduated in 54.
Right, Central High.
They both went to Central High. And my dad had his yearbook, and your dad is in that yearbook.
Probably he's at 20.
He was you know how they do a picture of the teams?
Mm-hmm.
And he was on the football team. And there's your dad.
I think you showed it to me.
Yeah, this little white sweatshirt. And I was like, that's Joan's dad. And that was, because in 1954. But because I think you'd said something about because when he came back from Japan, he missed all that school. So they just put him back at the grade or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I think all the non-English speakers got stuck in one class together. And it's like, well, good luck. Yeah, so you are the repository of a lot of my memories, not only school, but used to sometimes come out and work on my maternal grandparents' farm.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Makes a little pin money. But I always can say, hey, I did field work, man.
Every time I look at a grape vineyard, I think, I've tied vines like that.
Yes, I know how to.
To do that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's like, I can sound like one of those old fogies. Your child just needs to come out and pick some grapes and lay some trays and roll some trays. And,
I think so.
But this story
is
now here.
Oh, sorry. Sorry about that.
Don't mess us up.
I know. Don't mess it up.
I'll forgive you. It's been a long time.
Okay.
Okay. I guess we'll stay friends.
Okay, thank you. I'm very happy about that.
Okay.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.